The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Simon Bruce.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government statements, policies and actions?
Mr Speaker, yes.
Is she satisfied with annual GDP per capita growth of 0.7% in the last 12 months when it averaged 1.6% during the 5 years before she took office?
Mr Speaker, again, as I pointed out yesterday, over the term of the last government's term in office, they averaged at 0.9%, and that's obviously the quarterly growth that we've experienced. I also think it's worth pointing out, Mr Speaker, again, as I said yesterday, the 10-year long-term average is 1%, but is actually, over the next 4 years, forecast to be 1.2%. But, Mr Speaker, overall, even despite those figures, I acknowledged yesterday in the House and continue to do so, that there are improvements to be made, particularly in the area of productivity.
Does she accept that growth per person was stronger in the 5 years before she took office than under her government? If not, is she not aware that growth per person has halved under her government?
Mr Speaker, indeed, I have the figures in front of me, and when it comes to the quarterly change in GDP per capita, we've consistently had rates of 0.1, 0.2. These are numbers that there are numbers that the member opposite will well know, given it generated under his office 0.9% on average, have never been numbers particularly to crow about. Work needs to be done. Again, Mr Speaker, I'd also like to point out, the member mentioned yesterday, New Zealand's ranking in GDP per capita relative to the OECD in 2018, and that we were seventh worst. I think it is worth pointing out that New Zealand was rated third worst GDP per capita in the OECD when he was in government in 2017.
Is she concerned, given the services sector represents 70% of the New Zealand economy, that it grew only 0.2% last quarter, which is a decline when you take out the population growth?
Mr Speaker, of course, if we take the current account deficit generally, then we see actually a quite different picture. If he only wants to focus in on what's happening around net flows with services, tourist spending fell, yes, but at the same time we saw exports do perform particularly well. But, Mr Speaker, it is about both what's happening with our service sector but also our exports. Overall, Mr Speaker, relative to other OECD nations, we are performing relatively strongly.
What's the current account deficit got to do with the state services sector, 70% of our economy, that only grew 0.2% last quarter, a decline when you account for population growth?
Because, Mr Speaker, taking into account when we look at the weekly economic update that comes through from Treasury, they have made in particular references to services balance deterioration being relating to the tourist spending having fallen.
Why is our GDP growth slowing when the terms of trade and exports are rising?
Mr Speaker, again, as I have said in this House before, if the member wants to fixate solely on, for instance, the prices that our exporters are receiving, then that is perfectly his prerogative to do so. But of course, it is also about the investment decisions that are being made. And as every economist is pointing out, and the Reserve Bank themselves are pointing out, the international environment does have an impact on confidence and investment decisions. That is what's causing other economies to slow, but again, alongside those other economies, we are performing well.
What does she say then to Westpac economists this week, who stated, quote, New Zealand's economic growth has slowed in the last year, which we put down largely to domestic factors?
Mr. Speaker, even the Minister of Finance himself, in fact, most members in this House, bar him, I believe, have reflected on the fact that there is a slowdown. But, Mr. Speaker, what I continue to be frustrated by is the fact that the member seems to think the experience is unique to New Zealand, when we see that even, of course, the projections that are coming out of the IMF and the acknowledgement by the OECD is that we are in the middle of a global slowdown.
Does she think one of the reasons the services sector went backwards last quarter on a per capita basis is because of the decline in consumer confidence? And does she think that her government's higher petrol taxes is partly responsible for that weakening consumer confidence?
Mr. Speaker, I've actually been interested in the trajectory of consumer confidence, and the Westpac McDermott Miller Consumer Confidence Survey actually showed some really interesting numbers recently in the June quarter, demonstrating that actually confidence in the under 30-year-old age group reached a five-year high. I'd say that particularly may potentially be a reflection of what's happening in the housing market, a softening in Auckland, of course wages and wage growth are looking to outstrip now what we've seen in housing cost increases. So, Mr. Speaker, I think the member would do well to keep a fuller picture of what we're seeing in some of those consumer confidence numbers.
Is she aware that the Westpac Regional Economic Confidence Survey last week showed that 8 of New Zealand's 11 regions had a deterioration in economic confidence last quarter? And why does she think that is?
Mr. Speaker, I imagine because they read the news in the same way we do and see the issues around potential oil price increases coming out of Iran, China's economy softening, issues in the UK affecting trade as well. Mr. Speaker, we do not operate in isolation. We are an exporting trading nation that, of course, looks to attract investment in New Zealand. And, of course, when we have a global slowdown, it affects us.
Pretty simple,
sir. Is she...
Order. No, the member will resume a seat. That's not an appropriate interjection. The Deputy Prime Minister will withdraw and apologise.
No.
Oh, sorry, was it Ron Mark?
I withdraw and apologise.
That was a good invitation.
Is the Prime Minister's position that it's uncertainty in Iran that's led to 8 of New Zealand's 11 regions showing deteriorating economic confidence?
Mr. Speaker, that is not what I said.
Question number 2, Tamati Coffey.
Tēnā koe, te māngoi o te whare.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, what recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker, yesterday the OECD released their 2019 survey for New Zealand, and I'm sure that the House will be pleased to know that it said that economic growth in New Zealand is solid, and it commended the government for its sound economic management. Equally pleasing, Mr. Speaker, is that the survey's recommendations support the policy direction this government is taking, including in the wellbeing budget. The 2019 survey looked at New Zealand through a wellbeing frame, with the OECD finding that, quote, current wellbeing in New Zealand is generally high, with our performance very good for employment and unemployment, health, social support, air quality and life satisfaction.
Supplementary. Did the report highlight any risks to the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker, yes it did. The OECD said that the greatest risks facing the economy were a sharp economic contraction in China and also natural disasters. Mr. Speaker, that's why the government is managing the books responsibly so that we can face global economic headwinds and make sure we are in a strong position to deal with any event such as a natural disaster. The OECD said the greatest domestic risk was a housing market contraction, not because it expects one, but because of the high levels of indebtedness that have been built up in our housing market over previous decades. That's why, Mr. Speaker, this government has a comprehensive housing plan that includes reform of our urban planning systems, building affordable houses, and changes to the rules around foreign buyers and the extension of the Bright Line test.
What other reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Well, Mr. Speaker, today the International Monetary Fund released its concluding statement following its Article 4 mission. While they noted a slower rate of economic expansion, they did say that the near-term growth outlook is expected to improve on the back of government investment and accommodative monetary policy. They went on to say that Budget 2019 strikes an appropriate balance between supporting policy priorities and maintaining prudent debt levels. They noted that New Zealand's sound fiscal framework had been further strengthened by this government's approach. While these international organisations may have some different policy prescriptions from the government, they agree that the fundamentals of the economy are strong and that the government's priorities are focused in the right areas.
Can I ask the Minister of Finance as to whether he will share that information from the OECD and the IMF with the Leader of the Opposition? And yet another finance spokesperson.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I certainly intend to do that, and I've been sharing it with the House today, and I shall make sure it's done in very short sentences.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, does he agree with the Reserve Bank that there has been a, quote, sharp decline in GDP growth, end of quote, while he has been in office?
Mr. Speaker, take the opportunity to welcome the member to the portfolio. As I have previously acknowledged in this House, the rate of GDP growth in New Zealand has slowed. But I also note that Statistics New Zealand, who produce the GDP data, said in last week's release, quote, annual growth in GDP has been slowing since the December 2016 quarter.
Supplementary, what effect does an economy that is losing momentum have on the day-to-day lives of Kiwis?
Mr. Speaker, we all know that we need sustainable economic growth in New Zealand in order to support all of the things that we want for our country. And the New Zealand economy continues to grow, as the OECD said, at sustainable and solid levels. We also continue to grow at a faster rate than most of the countries that we compare ourselves to. So yes, sustainable economic growth is important. What's also important is caring about who shares in that growth.
Does he accept analysis from the OECD that healthcare, quote, is strongly dependent on the economy, and the GDP correlates with lower child mortality, higher life expectancy, higher literacy rates and greater life satisfaction?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, the member may not have heard my answer to his last supplementary question. We need sustainable economic growth. That means building that growth on lifting levels of productivity, actually investing in innovation in our regions and in infrastructure, all of the things that the last government failed to do. So while it's all very well to be able to quote the OECD, it's this government that actually has a plan to address the issues they've raised.
Did he note the comments today from the IMF saying on the risks to the downside, on the domestic side, the fiscal stimulus could be less expansionary if policy implementation were to be more gradual than expected? And does that, in quotes, mean if the government stuffs up the implementation like it has with KiwiBuild?
Mr. Speaker, I would invite the member to read all of the IMF statement, because I know just getting past the first few lines might be a struggle, but I'll help him out here. The financial year 19-20 budget strikes an appropriate balance between supporting policy priorities and maintaining prudent debt levels. New Zealand's sound fiscal framework has been strengthened further. Mr. Speaker, I could go on, but what the IMF is saying is that this government has got the balance of its priorities right.
Supplementary, is he willing to contemplate a return to budget deficits in 2020 or 2021 if the slowdown continues and his government continues significantly increasing spending?
Mr. Speaker, that is a hypothetical, and I have huge confidence in the businesses and the workers of New Zealand that are supported by a government that's investing in skills, in research and development, in infrastructure. We will be able to see a sustainably growing economy over that period. The member shouldn't take on the pessimistic tone.
Regarding that pessimistic tone, isn't the real threat to the economy coming not from anything I say, but what he and his government is doing with policy after policy driving down growth and a lack of delivery on infrastructure and housing.
Mr. Speaker, it is a little bit rich from a government that failed to invest in infrastructure year after year to stand up in this House and say that this government's not doing enough in that area. I think the parents of children who have been taught in assembly halls because that government failed to invest in schools will find that a bit rich. I think the people who are in hospitals who where the lifts don't work and the heating doesn't work because that government failed to invest in the health infrastructure know that it is this side of the House that has their best interests at heart.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Simon Bridges.
What role does he believe uncertainty in Iran has on 8 of 11 regions in New Zealand suffering dramatically declining economic confidence this last quarter?
Mr. Speaker, I think I would have thought the member who's come to the aid of his new spokesperson there would know that businesses in our regions are incredibly connected to the world, and what they're concerned about is making sure as they turn into an export business that there is a stable global economy. They know, Mr. Speaker, that New Zealand is an exporting nation that has to care about what happens in the rest of the world, but I understand that the member who asked that question's more focused on internal matters.
So to be clear, is he seriously saying it is uncertainty in Iran that is causing 8 of 11 regions in New Zealand to suffer sharply declining economic uncertainty?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the member is aware that that in Iran is one example of global uncertainty. The Prime Minister, when she spoke before, gave a number of examples. She mentioned Brexit, she mentioned the trade war between China and the US. That member well knows that New Zealand is a small nation, has to make sure that it's aware of what happens in the rest of the world. We know that the greatest threat to that member is sitting very close to him.
Question. The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Minister of Finance if the issue of business confidence is what's important here, how come the New Zealand share market is at new record levels?
Well, Mr. Speaker, indeed, there are many examples in the New Zealand economy of where businesses and companies are doing well, where people want to invest in innovation, where the government is alongside them making sure that we're adjusting to the climate change challenge and making sure that we're transforming the economy. It's the difference, Mr. Speaker, between a government that's firmly focused on building an economy that's appropriate for the 21st century and an opposition that's pessimistically looking in the rearview mirror.
Question number 4, the Honourable Judith Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Housing and Urban Development, how many of the 10,356 KiwiBuild houses contracted and committed to build are in either the Mount Roskill, Mangere, Northcote or Parirua developments or at the old Wakatipu High School site in Queenstown?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
I'm advised that there are 3,879 KiwiBuild homes currently forecast across those 5 sites. This figure will change as build dates are confirmed and contracts finalised.
Does he stand by his answers to written questions that there was no specific date for when houses at Mount Roskill, Mangere, Northcote and Porirua were committed to by this government?
That answer was correct based on the advice I received. There were no specific dates, but there were timeframes within which those properties, those houses are committed.
How can houses be contracted and committed to be built if there is no date on which the agreement was made?
Just to seek clarification of the member's question, that the member is saying that there was no date on which the contract or the commitment was made.
Yes. Shall I address that?
Yes, say it again.
Yes. So, yes, that's what says written questions. How can houses be contracted and committed to be built if there is no date on which the agreement was made, as disclosed in written questions answered today?
So the houses that are contracted and committed, that includes homes that are committed in the large-scale developments within a certain time frame and based on and homes that are based on finalised contracts. It's based on completed and approved business cases.
Order. The member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise.
No, I thought it was Mr Brownlee who made that. Or was it Mr Hudson who made... All right, I'm missing them today. Right. Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Which of the...
Order. Yesterday you took the blame for Amy. Well, I apologise to you and I'm sure Ms Adams will shout you something later. The Honourable Judith Collins.
Which of the HLC developments, Mount Roskill, Mangere, Northcote and Porirua, were not already planned before KiwiBuild came into existence and included in his various briefings as incoming minister?
So of those developments that the member has listed, only the one in Northcote was started by the previous national government, and in that development there was no guaranteed commitment to build a certain number of affordable homes. In all of the others, the business cases were completed and approved after the last election.
Point of order, Mr Speaker, my question was which of those four developments were not already planned and before the government came into existence and also included in his briefings as incoming minister?
And I'll get the minister to repeat his reply or to answer the question again. I'm sorry, he might have got it in there, but I was momentarily distracted.
Well, I guess it depends what the member means when she says planned. There was a press release by the former government that announced the intention to build some developments in those places, but there were no approved business cases for any other developments other than the Northcote one, and no commitment to a guaranteed number of new affordable homes.
Is his ministry being truthful when it says that KiwiBuild has contracted and committed to build 10,356 houses when there are no dated contracts for those?
Yes, the ministry is being absolutely truthful. There are 10,356 KiwiBuild houses either contracted through the buying off the plan scheme or committed and confirmed business cases over the next 10 years in a number of large-scale urban development projects.
Can he guarantee that following the KiwiBuild reset, the homes to be built at Mount Roskill will be marketed as KiwiBuild?
Well, as myself and the Prime Minister have been saying, all of the policy decisions involved in the reset will be announced when the reset is announced.
Question number five, Jenny Anderson.
Ete maungai.
To the Speaker.
My question is to the Minister for State Services. What reports has he seen on New Zealanders' trust and confidence in public services?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Good news, Mr Speaker. On Monday, the State Services Commission published the 2018 Kiwis Count Survey, which shows that trust in public services is at an all-time high. The Kiwis Count Survey provides a voice for New Zealanders who use public services and gives us a clearer picture of what the public service is doing well, and it also gives us an indication of where we can focus our activities to do better. Achieving a record service satisfaction high with the public on 43 commonly used public services, such as applying for New Zealand superannuation, for example, speaks to a culture change that the coalition government has been putting into place, ensuring that people's well-being is at the centre of what we do.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
What does the survey show about the public's satisfaction with Housing New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, more good news. It shows that a significant improvement in the public satisfaction with Housing New Zealand has occurred, the largest increase since 2012. Of those who applied for or living in a Housing New Zealand house or a community housing provider, their satisfaction increased by 13% between 2017 and 2018. Of those who applied for or received a housing subsidy or accommodation supplement, their satisfaction increased by 11% between 2017 and 2018.
Excellent.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Penny Hanare.
To the Minister, what does the survey show regarding public satisfaction with applying for a community services card?
Mr Speaker, it shows a record level of satisfaction from the public when they were asked about applying for or using a community services card. Again, the largest increase in 2018 since 2012.
Very good. The Honourable Penny Hanare.
To the Minister, what does the survey show about the public's perception of work and income support?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, more good news. It shows a significant change in the public's satisfaction with work and income, with the largest increase since 2012. And those applying for or receiving a sole parent or job seeker support payment, 6% up between 2017 and 2018.
Very good. The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr. Speaker, what does the survey show about the public's satisfaction with using services for employment or retraining opportunities?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, more good news, Mr. Speaker. The survey shows the largest increase since 2012 in people's perceptions of using public services for employment and retraining opportunities, with an 8% increase since 2017.
Well, I was going to say the next one can just be ditto, but...
Question number six, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. Does he agree the projected final District Health Board combined deficits for the 2018-19 financial year will be $389.5 million, as forecast by the Minister of Health from the March 2019 figures? If not, what does he expect the deficits will be?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, that forecast was made based on the best available information at the time. I do, however, expect the combined deficit to be larger than that, in large part because of one-off costs related to legacy issues inherited by this government. This includes historic Holidays Act pay issues that should have been resolved years ago, as I think the member knows, and writing down the value of assets related to the National Oracle solution, which has cost more than $100 million over 7 years, been much delayed and failed to deliver the anticipated benefits. Work on these long-standing issues is ongoing, and it would not be appropriate to speculate about their final financial cost and the impact on DHB deficits.
Are reports that the actual DHB combined deficits are now projected to be $460 million in the 2018-19 year accurate?
Mr. Speaker, I have not heard that particular projection. What I will say about the figure that was covered in his primary question is that that budget reflects the best available forecasts at the time.
When he said that his government is, quote, investing in our health system, which was neglected for 9 long years, end quote, did he expect that his government's investment in health would result in DHB deficits going down or up?
Mr. Speaker, I make no apologies for overseeing record investment in new mental health services. I make no apologies for investing in our ageing hospital facilities and funding DHBs more sustainably. The member might want to reflect on the legacy of underinvestment, workforce issues and deferred capital investment that his party left behind.
Order. Order. The member will now answer the question.
Can the member please repeat the question?
When he said that his government was, quote, investing in our health system, which has neglected for 9 long years, end quote, did he expect that his government's investment would result in DHB deficits going down or up?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I understand from those years of underinvestment that it will indeed take more than one or two budgets to ensure sustainability in our health sector. By DHB, the results do vary, because some DHBs require more investment to get onto a sustainable footing. They have been running off their balance sheets. Deficits have been going up since 2013 because of the shameful underfunding of that government. It is too soon to say what that will mean as an overall picture. DHB by DHB, it will vary because of that underinvestment and the effect and long-term impact it's had on their balance sheets and on the sustainability of their services. That government underfunded those services for 9 long years, and there are consequences of that.
When he said through his associate minister on June 13, quote, it's entirely possible there'll be small surpluses, balanced budgets, or small deficits, all according to circumstances, end quote, which of those three scenarios will be most heavily represented in the final figures?
Mr. Speaker, I think the legacy of underfunding means that probably more DHBs will be in deficit than posting surpluses at this stage. It is possible this government wants to see sustainable health services that provide the services that New Zealanders would expect and deserve. We're not running them into ground like that government did.
To the Minister, is he set to oversee the biggest combined DHB deficits in New Zealand history?
Mr. Speaker, I'll go back to my original answer for the member. Just to clarify what is driving the increases right now, These are historic issues. The Historic Holidays Act pay issues that I believe that member himself sought to resolve but failed to resolve, got taken off him by Stephen Joyce because he could not resolve it. Subsequently, if that's if memory serves me correctly, certainly the previous government did not solve that issue. On top of that, the National Oracle solution, a computer system which has failed to deliver the promised benefits, tens of millions of dollars, I suspect, will have to be written off because of the failed oversight of that member. And yes, that will mean that we will have deficits that we wouldn't want to see. That member and his government underinvested in health for 9 long years, and we will be investing ourselves for quite a period to set that right.
I think he did mean that. Question number 7, Mark Patterson.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Associate Minister of Education. What recent announcements has she made regarding early intervention learning support?
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
On Monday, I went to Torufetu Kindergarten in Porirua to announce another increase in early intervention funding from Budget 2019. This extra $24.8 million over the next 4 years will provide early intervention to preschool children who have communication, behaviour, development and disability needs. This is additional to the $21.5 million over 4 years provided as part of Budget 2018. It will be used to recruit additional specialists to work with children across all regions in the country.
Will this new funding reduce waiting lists?
Mr. Speaker, no, not on its own. The last 5 years have seen demand increase by 21% for behavioural services, 15% for the communication services and 15% for the early intervention services. We also saw a stagnation or slight decline in the specialist workforce over that same period. Rebuilding the specialist workforce and changing the way support is delivered is also required. The rollout of the learning support delivery model and changes in practice, bringing the services to the children rather than referring the children out and waiting, is showing that we can address demand pressures.
Order, the pair of you, just settle. Mark Patterson.
How will this new investment help grow the learning support specialist workforce?
Mr. Speaker, an additional 19 frontline specialists will be recruited to work with children across all regions in the country. This adds to the additional 120 recruited between December 2017 and March 2018. But there will also be an increase of 35 early intervention study awards worth $20,000 each and 28 speech language therapist scholarships worth $5,000 each over the next 4 years.
Question number 8, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr. Speaker, question to the Minister of Education. Does he stand by his involvement in collective bargaining and the offer made to primary principals?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, absolutely. And I do want to acknowledge and welcome the vote taken by primary school teachers who have resoundingly voted in favour of their settlement. Primary school teachers and principals told us that to retain and attract people into the profession, to stabilise the workforce, they needed to restore pay parity for the teachers that was lost in recent years. We listened to them on that and we acted. And around 30,000 primary teachers will now benefit from significant pay increases, with maximum base salary increases rising to $90,000 by July 2021. I am disappointed that primary principals have rejected the substantial offer that was made to them, but the Ministry of Education remains available to meet with the NZEI to discuss how the offer for primary principals could be repackaged to better meet their needs.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. Does he take some responsibility for the rejected settlement by 1,900 primary principals, given he took the unusual step of directly negotiating with the unions?
Mr. Speaker, I'm pretty sure the member called for that, but I also do take responsibility for the... I do take
Order.
Responsibility
He's
for
not.
The settlement of the primary school collective agreement, and I do take responsibility for the fact that we have yet to reach a settlement with the primary school principals. As the Minister of Education, of course, that is my job to take responsibility for those things. I would, however, note that the deal that the primary school principals rejected was recommended to them and endorsed by their union.
That's right.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. Given his comments around pay parity for teachers, does he commit to pay parity for principals?
Mr. Speaker, I have no problem with the concept of pay parity. I do note that that was not something that was claimed by primary school principals when these negotiations started, and the offer that they have rejected was recommended to them by their union.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Could I ask the Minister, is this the second time that pay parity has been given to the teachers and profession in this country? And what happened in between time?
Mr. Speaker, yes, for primary school teachers, this restores the pay parity that they were first given in the early 2000s after a long campaign.
The
late 1990s. It restores the pay parity that was lost. It was most notably lost about 3 years, nearly 4 years ago now, under the last agreement reached under the national government.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. Is he absolutely ruling out an increase to the envelope for primary teachers and principals? And why should educators believe him when the last time he said there was no more money, he magicked up $271 million?
Mr. Speaker, we don't need to increase the envelope for the primary school teachers because that settlement has now been reached and it has been ratified and endorsed by their members. We won't be putting more money into the primary principals agreement. We agreed to fund pay parity after extensive talks with the unions, both primary and secondary, on the basis that any extra money we were putting in was for a full and final settlement.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. Does he agree with Ross Intermediate School Principal Wayne Jenkins, who said there's little being presented to address the issues and concerns that face New Zealand principals every day? As an experienced principal in a large school, I feel let down by the offer. And did he let down the primary principals of New Zealand?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the principal's concerns own union would disagree with him because the union recommended and endorsed the offer when they presented it to their members.
Order. Question number 9, Mae Lubeck.
Thank you, Mr.
Speaker.
My question is to the Minister for Economic Development and reads, what is the government doing to boost innovation and support higher incomes and more jobs?
Oh, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable David Parker.
Belatedly. No, Mr. Speaker, the Coalition Government has a comprehensive plan to boost innovation. As part of the wellbeing budget, we announced the Venture Capital Fund to accelerate the development of high-growth New Zealand startups as they expand. The announcement of this fund has received overwhelming approval from all sectors of society as it will develop New Zealand's points of comparative advantage, supporting higher incomes and growing jobs. I note this is something that the OECD has been urging New Zealand governments to do for some time and that this active government's getting on and doing it.
Supplementary. What has the OECD said about New Zealand's capital markets and innovation?
In successive reports, the OECD has noted New Zealand's low productivity is caused in part by overinvestment in the speculative sector rather than investment in the productive sector. The OECD has noted that governments should support venture capital markets as these generate knowledge benefits across the economy. In 2013, the OECD specifically urged New Zealand to provide more support for the expansion of early-stage firms to help address our productivity problem. Follow-up reports from the OECD noted, perhaps with dismay, that no action had been taken. After years of inaction, this government's done it.
Well done.
Supplementary. What announcements will the government be making about innovation in the near future?
Mr. Speaker, as the OECD has said, New Zealand has for too long had a productivity problem. We believe that technology and innovation are important parts of the solution. And as part of the government's economic plan, next week we'll be launching our industry strategy from the knowledge wave to the digital age. This will be a call to arms for New Zealanders to work together to grow our points of comparative advantage so that we grow the jobs of the future as we lift exports, productivity and the incomes of New Zealanders.
To the Minister, how can he claim his government's policies are working when economic growth has more than halved, job creation is in decline and Stats New Zealand has just today said life satisfaction has become worse over the last 2 years?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's clear that the New Zealand economy is recalibrating away from an excessive reliance upon speculative investment
House price inflation on average in New Zealand has tailed off. We are seeing increased investment in the export sector. It's reflecting in the increasing sophisticated mix of our exports and by the booming increase in the number of technology exports earned by the TIN 200.
Question number 10, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Transport, when will construction begin on the city centre to Mangere light rail project, and how much is the project expected to cost?
Member wanted another, have another crack.
When will construction begin on the city centre to Mangere light rail, and how much is the project expected to cost?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Mr. Speaker, firstly, congratulations to the member on his promotion to transport spokesperson. Light rail is able to carry 11,000 commuters per hour. That's the equivalent of four lanes of motorway through one of the most built-up parts of the city, connecting commuters to some of the biggest concentrations of jobs in the country. And as I said yesterday in the House, the most recent cost estimate I've seen is around $4 billion. However, it is important to note that the business case and the final design will provide more certainty on the final cost and when construction will begin.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his statement? One of my first actions as Minister will be to have officials advise on how quickly we can start and how soon we can get it built. I would expect Queen Street to Mount Roskill within 4 years as a minimum. And nearly 2 years into his term as Transport Minister, how's that going for him?
Well, as the member knows, this is a major at-scale infrastructure construction project that would run the equivalent of four lanes of motorway right through the middle of one of the most built-up, intensely populated parts of our city. We are committed to taking the time to get it right, and we will be making announcements in due course.
Supplementary. Is it correct, as his colleague the Honourable Shane Jones has said, that the cost of the city centre to Mangere light rail project could be $7.6 billion?
Well, I almost always agree with my colleague the Honourable Shane Jones, but in this case the answer is no.
Does he have any idea as to why the Honourable Shane Jones would have said yesterday the cost of the city centre to Mangere light rail project could be $7.6 billion?
It's way above my pay grade to guess what's going on in the minds of my colleague.
I think that's a no.
Apparently. Will the government proceed with the city centre to Mangere light rail project if the business case is negative?
Well, a business case is not generally described as being positive or negative. A business case is what it is. A business case often includes a benefit-cost ratio, but those are two quite different things.
Benefit-cost ratio.
Question number 11, Brett Hudson.
Yeah, my question is to the Minister of Police and asks, does he stand by all his statements, policies and actions in relation to the government's firearms buyback scheme?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Yes, in the context in which they were given.
Supplementary. How can the price list for firearms buyback scheme be fair and reasonable compensation when the experts who designed it had only 5 hours to do so?
Well, Mr. Speaker, that is absolutely untrue. As I have already stated publicly several times, KPMG consulted widely on behalf of police. KPMG consulted farmers, hunters, dealers, valuers, auctioneers, collectors, gun clubs. So I would say to that member there were many, many five-hour meetings.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. My question was specifically to the experts, which were referenced by the Minister yesterday, not to a wider group.
Well, you can't get a yes-no. If the member's not satisfied with the answer, he can keep asking supplementaries.
Supplementary.
If the member thinks it is inaccurate, then he'll bring it up with the minister, and the minister will correct it. If he thinks it's deliberately inaccurate, he will write me a letter. But I cannot get for him the answer that he wants.
appreciate that, Mr Speaker. That's why I'm moving on with another supplementary.
I'm pleased you're moving on. I was getting
some appeals
from people in front of you.
How is it fair that there are not separate prices for E-category and A-category firearms as recommended by the experts in the KPMG report?
Mr Speaker, we had not separate E-category and A-category. What we want to do is take out any illegal firearm that we made illegal through registration, through legislation, I would say.
Supplementary. Why does he think that the firearms buyback will work when thousands of people are already saying that they won't hand their firearms back because they feel ripped off by the Minister's proposals?
There are two things I'd say to that, Mr Speaker. First of all, thousands of people are not saying they feel ripped off. Our feedback is 80% of all phone calls are positive, only about 5% are negative. Secondly, we are not ripping people off at all. And thirdly, Mr Speaker, if people do not comply with the law, they face up to 5 years in jail. And I trust the good, hard-working people of New Zealand are law-abiding and will obey the law.
Question number 12, Willow Jean Prime.
Tēnā koe te mangai e tupari. My question is to the Minister of Employment. What reports, if any, has he seen on he pautama rangatahi?
Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr Speaker, I've seen figures that show that there's nearly $21 million in funding committed so far over the next 4 years to target just over 3,750 rangatahi. Currently, we have 1,700 young people participating on HPR programs around the regions.
Has the Minister seen any specific outcomes for he pautama rangatahi programs?
Mr Speaker, I've been really pleased with what I'm seeing out in the regions. Some of our young people have significant barriers to employment, and I'm pleased to share with the House that these programs are making a real difference in the lives of rangatahi. For example, in the Northland College Pine Project, all 16 participants completed their training, obtaining the Level 2 Certificate in New Zealand Forestry Qualification. 12 of these rangatahi are still in full-time employment, and 3 have been promoted to crew boss.
What is the impact he pautama rangatahi is having in our communities?
Mr Speaker, I want to share with the House the success a program like the Development Hub with its Initiate program has had in the Hawke's Bay community, a community-based social enterprise that matches training for local rangatahi wahine with skills and job shortages in the area. 36 women started the program and 33 completed, and currently 27 have remained in continuous education or employment since then. That's 27 whānau, Mr Speaker, that are seeing positive impacts in their lives, and he pautama rangatahi has played a significant part in that and in our communities.
That concludes oral questions.